TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Melting of the Arctic Sea Ice with Cambridge glaciology professor Peter Wadhams. Only days before Professor Wadhams set off on his 2015 research voyage to the Arctic, the UK blogger Nick Breeze did an interview with him, asking him about the latest data on the disappearing Arctic sea ice. Peter Wadhams is Professor of Ocean Physics at the University of Cambridge, UK, with over 40 years of research on Arctic sea ice, icebergs, and polar oceanography. He's considered one of the leading experts in his field. This interview is posted on the website envisionation.co.uk. Nick Breeze and Brew Pierce set up the site as a place to present thoughts, ideas, and interviews on the developing crisis of climate change and on our collective and individual response to it. They write that, quote, "One major challenge facing our generation right now is the need to transition away from hydrocarbon energy sources, coal, oil, and gas. Failure to achieve this in a short time frame will mean that the planet warms up unstoppably to unprecedented levels in which civilization can no longer function. Never has there been a greater need for global cooperation to solve the biggest crisis that we, as a species, have ever encountered." End quote. The urgency of this matter stands in stark contrast to Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change computer models. They claim that Arctic summer sea ice will not disappear until 2050, or even 2100. Professor Wadhams argues that this is based on serious errors in computer modeling and predicts an ice-free Arctic summer ocean by 2020, with very few remnants of sea ice along some coastal zones and blocking channels in the Northwest Passage. When the interview took place at the end of September 2015, we had just heard on the news that the sea ice minimum at the end of the Arctic summer was the fourth lowest on record. It stands at about half of the ice that used to cover the same area. You will hear in a moment the scientific evidence based on his four decades of research in the Arctic that led Professor Wadhams to that timeline. What is so interesting and worrisome about this interview is that Wadhams delivers a sequence of arguments that make clear that we're not only losing the refrigerator in the Arctic that reflected back into space 80 to 90% of the heat of the sun, but that consequences and feedback mechanisms are already destabilizing the climate of the Northern Hemisphere, way beyond the boundaries of the Arctic. In the interview you heard last week, Wadhams had spoken about the increased methane releases from the shallow oceans and permafrost areas along the continental shelves that were once protected by a layer of snow or sea ice. He says this will dramatically increase the greenhouse gases that are warming the planet. In this interview, he goes into more detail about how the disappearance of the sea ice changes the vortex of the North Pole. The polar vortex is a persistent, large-scale cyclone circling the poles. This cold core, low-pressure area strengthens in the winter and weakens in the summer because of the temperature difference between the equator and the poles. The assumption is now that reduced snow cover and sea ice in the Arctic reflect less sunlight, which in turn alters the pressure and temperature gradient of the polar vortex, causing it to weaken or collapse. and that causes the jet stream, which is the strong air current at the boundary of the polar vortex, to slow down. We are already familiar with the meteorological maps that show that the jet stream develops much bigger meanders, and the meanders do not progress around the planet very fast. That, Wadham says, explains the persistent anomalous weather patterns at different longitudes around the planet that we are already experiencing, bringing floods, droughts, and unusual cold spells. It is assumed that a recent blocking event occurred when high pressure over Greenland steered Hurricane Sandy into the northern mid-Atlantic states. Here is Nick Breeze beginning the interview with Professor Peter Wadhams by asking about the latest news. My apologies for the low sound quality of this interview done on Skype.
We've just heard in the news that the Arctic sea ice minimum for this year is the fourth lowest on record, with 4.4 million square kilometres of sea ice remaining. Can you put that in the context of how fast the ice has melted away and why we might reach a summer ice-free Arctic ahead of IPCC projections that say somewhere between 2050 and 2100?
Yes, 4.4 million is about half of the area that the ice used to occupy in the summer. It's a bit above the absolute minimum, which happened in 2012, which was 3.4, but the trend is rapidly downwards, and the trend of summer area is still showing a disappearance of the ice in summer by about 2020, or something like that, certainly not after 2020. And there's no countervailing force to bring the ice back up again. It's on the way down. So the observations show that we can expect a summer ice-free Arctic by 2020, maybe earlier. What's so bizarre is that the computer models that are used are predicting something like late this century as the time for the summer ice to disappear, which is quite impossible. It's completely impossible that it could last that long. So we have a huge disconnect between the models.
As an Arctic researcher who goes to the Arctic, you're seeing the quality of the ice. And now we're talking about 4.5 million square kilometres. What's the quality of that ice like?
Well, it's really rotted. I mean, I was up there last August, and I'm going up there again next week. And the ice that remained, which of course would show up on the satellite imagery and show us as an area of ice, was very, very thin and completely rotted away, so that a single storm would be enough to clear out huge areas of ice. So we're still, although the trend this year is to be bottoming out at 4.4, there's still time for a single storm to take away another huge area of the ice, because it's so thin and rotted. Completely unlike the way it used to be in summer.
When we talk about an ice-free Arctic, how many square kilometres are we talking about? Is it completely gone? Or?
The assumption is that there might be about 1 million square kilometres left of ice that's up against coastlines, blocking channels in the Northwest Passage, those kinds of things, sort of broken up, loose bits of ice that are still around. The main core is the Central Arctic Basin, and the area around the North Pole.
And can you describe what happens as we lose the reflective white snow in that basin and replace it with dark blue ocean?
Well, there's a huge decrease in albedo. That's the amount of energy reflected straight back out into space. If you look at fresh snow, its albedo is about 80 to 90%, so nearly everything gets reflected back out. The sort of old snow or old sea ice that's covered with melt pools and rotting away in summer has an albedo of about 0.5 or 0.6. But open water or bare land or forest without snow on it has an albedo of less than 0.1. So there's a massive drop in albedo as soon as you take the snow away or the ice away. And that means that much more energy from the sun is retained by the surface, and that accelerates the warming.
A lot of energy is going into melting the ice. Once the ice is gone, where does that energy go? It's going into the water and accelerating the warming of the ocean.
Yes, once the sea ice has melted, the energy the solar energy in summer is absorbed by the water, warms the water up. And in the case of the deep Arctic, the central Arctic Ocean, that's just warming up a thin layer at the surface. But in the case of the continental shelves, which is about a third of the area of the Arctic, you're warming the whole water column because the water column's only about 50 metres deep. And once you warm the water column, you're warming the seabed, and that's causing problems in accelerating the thawing of subsea permafrost.
And with subsea permafrost thawing, that in turn, what's the effect of that? What's the tangible effect?
There's been evidence for several years of increasing methane emissions from offshore. That's the work that the Russians have been doing. That's showing a rapid growth in volume of methane, which could become a kind of a pulse sufficient to accelerate climate change. But on a slower time scale, there's melting going on around the whole of the Northern Hemisphere that's got permafrost on land. That permafrost is thawing, and so there's methane being released or generated by that thawing on a slower scale than the offshore, but ultimately there's more of it because there's such a huge area of permafrost on land to melt. So we'll be seeing, whether we like it or not, a big input of methane into the atmosphere, whether it's rapid from the offshore parts of the Arctic now, or whether it's slower over the next few years and decades from the melting of permafrost on land.
Is there any evidence that longer-term changes in the Earth system due to melting sea ice are starting to become evident, and even if that's outside the Arctic or in the periphery?
Yes, well, I mean, there's a couple of things. One is sea level rise. That global sea level rise is accelerating, and the predictions are that it will accelerate a lot more because of various effects due to melting ice. Firstly, the warming of the atmosphere in over Greenland, because the sea ice is replaced by water, causes an increase in the melt rate of the Greenland ice sheet. But we're also coming to certain sort of tipping points in Greenland and Antarctica, where the melt of the ice sheet causes the ice sheet to detach itself from the seabed and have big retreats. So the predictions about the glaciological effects of sea ice retreat on the Antarctic and Arctic ice sheets really show that this sea level rise this century is going to be a lot more than the 60 centimetres that IPCC predicts. And James Hansen, for instance, is saying it might be more like 4 metres, which would be catastrophic. And another effect, of course, of sea ice retreat in the Arctic has been this connection with extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere generally, and that has an impact on food production, because the extreme weather events that we're getting in Europe and in America impinge on the sort of big food producing temperate regions for the Northern Hemisphere.
So these are real impacts that are
yes.
starting to become.
You are listening to an interview with the Cambridge glaciology professor Peter Wadhams. The interviewer is Nick Breeze, a British blogger with a website envisionation.co.uk. I hope the quality of the information makes up for the not-so-great sound of this Skype connection. Here's Nick.
With the effects we've already mentioned contributing to accelerating warming, do you think that we are seeing a self-reinforcing feedback develop in the Arctic, where the heating continues regardless of human greenhouse gas emissions?
That's the problem, and the fear of a runaway warming is that when the feedbacks become dominant, then you can have feedback without having to drive it anymore. And already that's almost happening. For instance, if you analyse the extra warming produced by the retreat of sea ice, it's about, already been, papers have been published on this, it's about a quarter of the direct effect of adding greenhouse gases. So you add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, you warm the climate, the warming leads to sea ice retreat, but the albedo effect reduction of the sea ice retreat is like adding a quarter to the amount of carbon dioxide you're adding to the atmosphere. And then the retreat of the snow line, which is of the same magnitude, adds another quarter. So we're already, just from Arctic feedbacks, we're adding 50% to the amount of warming that we're getting from the greenhouse gases alone. So the greenhouse gases are the drivers, but the response is much greater than what you'd expect as a direct response to that extra amount of carbon causing extra radiative forcing. So you add on some more feedbacks, and there's a lot more feedbacks around, and you will end up getting an effect which is maybe double what you would get from the heating alone. And you can reach a point where the feedbacks are self mutually reinforcing, to the point where you don't need the original driving force anymore. They'll work together to keep the changes going.
And is that point easy to identify?
No, it's not, but I suspect we're approaching it.
The Met Office often cite the jet stream meandering as the reason for much of the persistent weather patterns, and especially the extreme weather patterns that affect the UK, whether it's long hot spells or long periods of rain. And is there evidence to suggest a link with the Arctic sea ice decline?
Well, yes. I mean, there's a mechanism being proposed for that, whereby the decline of the sea ice causes a change in the circulation, the atmospheric circulation within the polar vortex. That's the region north of the boundary with subpolar air masses. And that causes the jet stream, which is the strong air current at that boundary, to slow down. And slowing down means it develops much bigger meanders, and the meanders don't sort of precess around the planet very fast. So you get stuck in a region where there's either a big lobe of cold air coming down where it normally isn't to be found, or you get stuck in a region where there's a lobe of warm air. So you can get persistent anomalous weather patterns at different longitudes around the planet, and that tends to produce horrendous effects as far as food production and disasters like floods and so on.
If the current state of the Arctic is causing global weather disruption, do you think we have now seen the worst of it, or could weather patterns become more unpredictable?
Well, they could become more unpredictable. I mean, for instance, this link between sea ice retreat and the jet stream, there's been studies which show that you can extend that down into the tropical Atlantic, and it's likely that there will be more severe hurricanes occurring. Part of that is also the reduction in the vigour of the thermohaline circulation, so that the heated water in the tropical Atlantic doesn't move up across the Atlantic and up to Europe as well as it did. So we're getting less warming because of that, but you're getting more warming in the tropical Atlantic, so that all the predictions are for more vigorous hurricanes, and of course hurricanes are pretty vigorous anyway at the moment. Yeah. So you might start having sort of super hurricanes, which are a result of the extra warming of the surface waters in the tropical seas.
What would it take to reverse the melting of the polar ice cap and restore the Arctic sea ice?
Well, I kind of fear you can't do it without reducing the temperature of the entire planet. You can't have a regional effect, although there's some people think that you can. For instance, the idea is of geoengineering, where you can put aerosols into the atmosphere to increase the albedo of the planet. They tend to produce planetary-wide effects. But if you do use another geoengineering technique, which is marine cloud brightening, where you put water, finely divided water particles, into the bottoms of clouds, that selectively whitens clouds in certain regions. And models at least suggest that you might have some control over where you achieve the cooling. So there's some hope that you might be able to achieve a regional cooling with marine cloud brightening, which could bring back some sea ice. I mean, the models show an advance of sea ice if you do your marine cloud brightening in the northern hemisphere. So there's a one possible mechanism whereby you don't have to cool down the whole planet to bring back the ice. You can cool down regionally using marine cloud brightening.
And are these technologies ready to go?
Everything is just waiting on sufficient seriousness being taken by politicians that they put lots of money into these key things that can actually have an impact.
You are leaving for the Arctic on a research expedition very shortly. Can you tell us where you're headed, what you're looking for, and who the parties involved are in this expedition?
Well, we're going on the Sikuliak, which is a new icebreaker from the University of Alaska. And we're all partners in a project called Sea State, which is looking at the impact of the open water in the Arctic in causing a feedback which accelerates the loss of ice. And one of the problems is all the observations that anybody's made have been showing the sea ice retreating very fast in summer. The mechanisms that are not put into models, so the modellers say, oh, it can't possibly be retreating that fast because our model says it's not. What that means is the modellers aren't modelling all the physical processes. And one of the processes that could be important is that as the sea ice retreats and you have more open water, you have more wave energy, and the waves interact with the sea ice and break it up so that it melts faster, so that you're getting a marginal ice zone around the edge of the ice, of ice being broken up by waves. And that could be the mechanism which is making the ice retreat faster, and that will make it go faster and faster because as the sea ice retreats more, you have more and more open water. So we're going up there with a bunch of wave buoys which we're putting into the ice, monitoring the penetration of waves into ice, how far the waves get, how much ice do they break up. And so we'll be working in the ice edge region, but we might have to go a long way north to find that ice edge. We're leaving from Alaska and we're heading north, so we might have to get quite a long way towards the North Pole before we come into ice that we can work with.
How long do you think you'll be away?
7 weeks.
Do you think the politicians who will meet in Paris in December at the UN climate talks really understand the threat to society from these changes that are going on right now?
I don't think they do, no. Certainly they haven't shown any signs of it up to now, with all the kind of pretty pathetic and useless agreements that have been made up to now, which really have had no impact at all on climate. We're still getting an exponential increase in carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere that's even more exponential than it used to be. So all of the promises of politicians have actually not translated into any action at all. So the track record is terrible. And I think that they don't recognise how absolutely urgent it is to take very, very serious action now. What they think is there's a sort of let's do plan B, which is we sit here and monitor climate change, and then if we find that it's really getting bad, then we'll start doing something. But the trouble is, it's getting, the effects are accelerating such that if you start taking action in the future, it will be too late because of the ratchet effect of CO2. It lasts such a long time in the atmosphere that if you keep pumping it in, you're going to suffer the consequences for a long time to come, 1,000 years. And so you can't, you have to stop doing that now in order to have a level in the atmosphere which is not going to be catastrophic. So everything has to be done now, but politicians don't have the concept of doing things now because they don't want to upset anybody, they don't want to lose votes. They would always prefer to push it beyond the next election.
Yeah, a politician might say, well, it's extremely complex trying to get everyone to agree to even do one thing. And if you could persuade world leaders to do one thing at this conference, what do you think that one thing would be?
Well, I think it would be to immediately make the top priority everywhere the replacement of fossil fuel use by renewables in concrete ways. I mean, go for seriously going for solar power because it's now cheap and it's effective. It's not a joke anymore, and you can replace a huge amount of our fossil fuel use by solar if you make the effort. And your mentality should no longer be the mentality of coal and oil as the basis of industry or the basis of life. The mentality should be, let's only use energy that is renewable. And if they can take on that, then it is remarkable how quickly we could have a transformation in the world, hopefully.
That was Professor Peter Wadhams. He's professor of ocean physics at the University of Cambridge, UK, with over 40 years of research on Arctic sea ice. He's considered one of the leading experts in his field. He's head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group in the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge, the same department where Stephen Hawking is teaching. Wadhams, as you just heard, is considering using geoengineering techniques to halt the Arctic melt because he fears that humanity will not be ready to end the use of fossil fuels within the next 10 to 15 years to cool the planet sufficiently to also halt the melting in the Arctic. Thanks to Nick Breeze for the interview at the end of September 2015. You can watch the YouTube film on the website that he and Brew Pierce set up. Envisionation.co.uk is a place to present thoughts, ideas, and interviews on the developing crisis of climate change and our collective and individual response to it. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.